Good evening, listeners. I hope you dressed to impress, because today we're going to be talking about costume designer as well as production designer, which is a little bit outside my realm of expertise, but I'm very excited to be discussing Aiko Ishioka. And joining me is Emma Gerard. Hi, Emma.
Hi, I'm wearing my red bandit mask right now.
Your identity is concealed. So Emma, when you pitched this, I got really excited because, like, I think a lot of the time people pitch filmmakers or like their body of work or a specific film, but I think it's sort of rare to have a conversation about film from this angle of a designer who's made costumes and who's done production design. But what made you want to discuss Aiko Ishioka's work?
I don't know. I've been interested in her work for a really long time. And yeah, like you said, we've never really talked about how sort of different aspects of production design come together to help a filmmaker's vision. And I think, I mean, there's a lot of sort of different modes of costume design in particular, and the way that they can function to help tell a story are always different, but the designs of Aiko Ishioka are sort of recognizable and iconic by themselves, and I think they sort of always steal the show. They're always like very noticeable in the films mm-hmm. that she worked on.
I mean, we should probably mention which films she worked on. I guess notably the ones we're going to be focusing on, it's Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula, and I guess the first four films directed by Tarsem Singh. So that would be The Cell, The Fall, Immortals, and Mirror Mirror. And it's not a lot of film work. You know, I think there's some costume designers I was looking, they have like 150 credits, 250 credits, some of them, you know, so it's a relatively small bit of work. But like you said, it's incredibly show-stealing. It's very iconic, a lot of the costumes. It's something that kind of sticks in your mind after you've seen the films. I think maybe like this is one of only a handful of costume designers that I sort of knew about by name maybe before you pitched this. I was excited because it's somebody who I kind of had a vague idea of what she had worked on, but never really thought to look at these films specifically through her work. You know, it's like a little bit different when you watch a film and you kind of put aside, okay, I'm going to stop thinking about the performances and stop thinking about the Philip Glass soundtrack and just kind of focus on this one specific person's artistic contribution to the film, and you maybe come away with some different takeaways just by focusing on a certain element. So I thought that was fun.
Yeah, all these films we watched for this episode I had seen before, and I think it was, even though I was a fan of her work, I think it was my first time focusing on exactly what they do in the movie. It might also be worth mentioning that Aiko Ishioka didn't start out as a costume designer, and I don't think she ever really considered herself a professional costume mm-hmm. designer. She started a graphic design firm in Japan when it was a total boys club, but she was, you know, determined and bold and did it anyway. And she was really well known for her ad directing, especially for a Japanese boutique department store called Parco. And she did a huge body of work for this. And one of the best known things I think she did is an ad with Faye Dunaway where she's eating an egg seductively. And it's on YouTube. You should absolutely look it up. And then, you know, after she had a pretty large body of design work together, she'd won awards for some album designs she'd done. Then she put a book together, and Paul Schrader saw this and wanted to work with her. And Francis Ford Coppola knew her work because she'd done the Japanese poster for Apocalypse Now, and so that's what brought her to work with him.
I think maybe she also did the cover for Eleanor Coppola's book about the making of Apocalypse Now, too, or...
Oh, cool.
Or maybe they just reuse those images, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a really cool poster. It's like, it's super wide in format, and it uses the surfing scene, and it's like this gorgeous illustration of like waves and Marlon Brando's head. It's kind of nuts. Yeah, and she's
I like just all the visual elements it captures. Like, it's surfing, helicopters, giant Marlon Brando head.
Yeah, it totally makes sense for the movie if you've seen it, but it's so different from what you, especially now, like, poster design has become, like, completely formulaic for movies. Like, you don't even see the poster design you used to see in America in the 20th century anymore. So, that's, yeah.
I was trying to figure out if Coppola was the person who recommended her to work on Mishima, since he was one of the producers.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that she said before she met Coppola, she got to meet Eleanor Coppola, and he had a copy of her book.
Okay.
I think the book had a great deal with her becoming more well-known, especially in America. It was kind of a big deal. She really developed... A lot of her work for Parco, she was sort of aiming to do this, like, international style. She was always interested in this idea of East meets West, and she would make these ads that didn't necessarily showcase the clothing the company was selling. It would have celebrities or photos from just normal people in India, and she would bring all these sort of multicultural elements together, but also put something of an imaginative twist in them. So she was always had this idea of design that references things that are in a global imagination and then, like, making them even more impactful visually. And I can see how that could be really useful for a production like Mishima, especially.
Right. So. Absolutely, because that's a total East meets West sort of production where you had American writer, director, you know, and sort of a mix of crew. And Mishima himself as a figure, I think, sort of embodies a kind of mixture of that East meets West also in his maybe appeal to international literature. And I think in the audio commentary, Paul Schrader talks a little bit about this idea of the Japanesque, this idea of sort of the exotic elements of Japanese culture that appeal to the West sort of being filtered back through into a Japanese perspective. So it's like Mishima appropriating sort of these elements that might be considered exotic, but there's also a lot of elements in that film of his interest in international or like European artwork, photography.
It's a motif in the movie for sure.
She said that when she was first asked or first speaking to Paul Schrader about doing it, she said she really disliked Mishima, and he said that was perfect. And she was mostly in charge of designing the theatrical adaptations of his book that are incorporated to the film, since there's flashbacks to his youth, which are in black and white. There's the present day stuff of his last day when he would kill himself. That's sort of a more realistic style. And then there's three adaptations of his stories in the film, which I guess it's Golden Pavilion, Kyoko's House, and Runaway Horses. And each one has sort of a different style, but they're all done in this very theatrical style with sort of abstract sets and abstract elements and these really wild color palettes. Each one kind of gives you a different aspect of who Mishima was. And it all works together to paint this very specific portrait of a very complex figure, I think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting movie, because I know we've talked before about how biopics, especially about artists that are just try to be straight biographies, can be totally unbearable.
Yeah.
And this movie really runs with the idea of, like, having these sort of different facets of his life coming together, and they're all represented, as you said, in different visual styles, and then they're, like, pulled together by this, like, abstract soundtrack that Philip Glass, where it's, like, almost completely repetitive, but it can change moods completely at the same time. And, yeah, it's those sort of play within a play parts that Eiko was the production designer of. Like she sort of, it was her first movie that she was working on, so they really just had her focus on those literary adaptation fantasies.
Yeah, before when we were talking about the adaptations of painters' lives on film, you know, that's hard, and painting's visual. To do a writer's life on film, I think that's probably even more challenging, because writing's not sort of inherently visual, and a lot of writers, you know, even with more interesting lives, what you really want to explore is their life through their writing. So I think Mishima, it kind of feels like it's in that category of films like Naked Lunch, where it's sort of smashing their biography together with adaptations of their writing to give you a sense of who they were.
Yeah, it does a good job, I think, of showing like sort of the evolution of his political thought through his writing too, because it starts with the Temple of the Golden Pavilion, where it's about sort of the survival in his mind of beauty through Japanese culture, and survive, how it's going to survive World War II. And then it goes to the present day, and it's a sort of, I haven't read Kyoka's House, but it seems like it's sort of like a disdainful look at the present culture of Japan, or at least the culture of Japan, right, in the post-war period.
I know, in the behind the scenes, Ayako Ishioka said, like, she tried to make it very vulgar, like that vulgar pink, and sort of deliberately put it in bad taste.
I love that, the bad taste style, and like pink is the color of bad taste.
She said so many people would compliment her on those sets specifically, how they much
they
like them.
They remind me now of like how like internet, like vaporwave art is, which is also like an intentional bad taste style.
That also has a lot of pink usually. It's like the same font as the Drive. The Nicholas Winning reference titles.
That I think he uses
wave.
I think he uses an intentional bad taste style too. Like
that sort of 80s, very gaudy looking fonts and colors, and like that Kyoko's House section, especially like some of the stuff you see people wearing, or just how like cluttered it all looks. You know, there's sort of like a deliberate messiness to it, which, I mean, it's interesting, but like it's obviously a very conscious choice.
Yeah, I can see how it could be popular in the 80s too, because I was thinking, I was like, oh, this is like 1983, so I guess they were working on it in 82, and this would have been like not long after like the Memphis Design Show, which was the design show that sort of started that 80s gaudy, like pastel color aesthetic, and it's got these like bright magenta backgrounds with like this green palm plant on it, and like dramatic like stage lighting shadows, and like people would have loved this in the 80s.
But it seems very astute to associate that with bad taste so early on, when that was kind of the trend. But I don't. And then the Runaway Horses, it's black and white and red all over. That has one of my favorite bits of production design, which is that sunken torii gate.
Oh, so good.
I know. And she talked a bit about how Mishima's relationship with Shintoism was sort of, I guess, a little bit slanted, or there was something a little bit crooked about that, and how she wanted to represent that by having the torii gate on a slant. And like it creates such an eerie space that you get an impression of is inside this person's head.
Yeah.
We have these student conspirators, you know, coming up with their assassination plan. And, like, you know, the use of the black box space. I think it's in Kyoko's House where you even see the set change happen within the film itself. Like, you see the runners move and change the set while you're watching the film, which I think whenever somebody does something like that in film, you're running the risk of having it turn into theater, you know, instead of having it be that. But like I think Mishima, it's one of those films that succeeds in making that theatricality also very cinematic.
Yeah, and and you can't do in stage what the movie does, which is sort of like I mean, you could have a play that used these three set designs together, but you can't have it weaving all of the rest of the story together, which is what I think its function is. It's like when you get to the end of his life and they're showing this story about like youth with extremist ideals, and it's just like black and white, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like this is like a world of absolutism. And then it starts like there's this like absolute white Shinto scene, and then like this red, like bloody red, is like setting on it. That has like it's so foreboding and like dangerous feeling.
I mean, it feels inevitable. Like it has sort of a similar kind of inevitability of, I guess, Paul Schrader, that's something that usually comes through in his films, like the Taxi Driver, although Mishima's specific pathology seems so much more, I guess, specific, if that makes sense, or or so much more baroque anyway, like these very sort of intricate patterns that sort of lead to a very specific, I guess, fantasy or performance art that happened to coincide with his suicide. So yeah, very interesting, but also somebody who you kind of feel cautious about. Now, I like that the design work kind of maybe tips you off to that in certain ways. Like there is sort of a natural trepidation that you have even when you feel like you're very deep inside this person's psychology watching the film. And then I guess the film where she, Eiko Ishioka, I guess became associated with the costume design very much was the Coppola's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola Bram Stoker's Dracula, which right away you're sort of smashed with the boldness of these costumes, with the little prologue having Dracula show up in this red suit of armor that I guess was designed to look like exposed muscles,
Yeah, absolutely.
and it gives you this sort of instant association with his sort of strength, this muscular strength with the sort of red violence. It's such a striking image, and I think she said she had never watched a Dracula film before
That was
coming on to work
probably
on it.
helpful.
I
Yeah.
think so.
Coppola's talked a lot about like his intentions with that movie, and it was that he wanted to it's Bram Stoker's Dracula. He wanted to not make a Dracula movie that was based on all the other Dracula movies. He wanted to do Bram Stoker's Dracula. So his idea was to have something that felt like it belonged at in Bram Stoker's time and like the fin de siècle.
Right. I remember reading the novel, and I was almost disappointed when I read it at the time because it had so little to do with the any of the film versions I had seen. And like if you asked somebody, oh, what does Dracula look like, they'd tell you, oh, he's got the cape, and they could describe a costume for a sort of archetypical Dracula that's not necessarily present in the novel, and I think definitely not present in this film adaptation. So it has that kind of return to the novel and to try and create something fresh from it instead of going back to the old, Lugosi or Christopher Lee kind of looks of Dracula. But a number of other characters have very interesting costumes, which maybe express things about them as well. Like, I mean, sometimes it's a little bit more subtle. Like she was talking about the costume for Winona Ryder, where she said she wanted it to be very sort of Victorian and very kind of conservative and a little bit repressed with the high neck and very tight. And in contrast to Sadie Frost as Lucy, her costume is very sort of flowing and more open and sexual. Like she has that snake dress at one point.
Oh, I love the snake dress. And it made me think too of like the symbolist painters. A lot of them, like I thought of, I think it's Max von Stuck, or maybe it's the other von Stuck, but his painting of Eve with the big snake on her shoulder, and she's wearing it like a scarf. Also, Lucy and Mina are wearing like the same colors at the beginning of the movie. Like
Right.
she's using it to show how close they are, but then Lucy starts turning into the vampire, so her costumes change along with
Right.
that.
I mean, maybe my favorite costume that she's done is the burial gown for Lucy.
I love
And
that.
I was just thinking the other night, watching it, how much it reminds me of the what's the dinosaur called? Dilophosaurus from the Jurassic Park, where it has the big frills and it spits poison at Newman from Seinfeld's face. And then watching
Yeah.
the special features, she said she actually drew inspiration from lizards for creating that gown. And like you, I think you can totally see it, that very, very wide collar. It's like a lizard's frill, and it just makes her seem so dangerous when she's snarling. I like that so much.
Yeah, the costumes bring a lot of animal imagery into the movie,
Right.
like Dracula is always sort of this ambiguous, like you don't know if he's a wolf or a human or a bat or something else, depending on his costume. I think Iko said she even wanted him to be like sort of gender ambiguous, like,
Yeah.
and just sort of this like unknown and animal aspect of him is what makes him scary. And then yeah, there's the lizards and the snakes with Lucy, and oh, and I love Renfield when he's in a straitjacket and he literally looks like worms. And
I
we're
know,
like,
he's got
yeah,
this
he's the worm
long,
guy. Makes
like
sense.
when they become untied, it's just like hanging down. I mean, that's also very insect-like, like the legs or antennae. You know, I like Renfield eating bugs, but he's also kind of like a bug compared to Dracula.
Yeah. I mean, you are what you eat.
Exactly.
And Dracula is
Little
dressed
souls.
consistently in red through the movie. He's just a
Right.
flowing sea of blood.
Well, probably the most famous costume in the movie, it's the one Gary Oldman wears when Jonathan Harker first shows up, and it's that in combination with the wig that's been parodied in everything from Simpsons to Mel Brooks' Dracula Didn't Loving It.
Yeah.
But that I always think, like, when you go out on a limb and do something that bold, either costume wise or really in any aspect of filmmaking, you're kind of hoping to get a reaction out of people, and it could be a very good reaction, but you also kind of run the risk of parody, or run the risk of people kind of reacting to something that risks being absurd, so like I think
Right.
that's kind of what it means to take a chance on these costumes. Like I was listening to people talking about working on The Cell with Tar Sim, and apparently his motto was, if it's absurd, that's bad. If it's absurd, that's great. Or maybe it was
Interesting.
ridiculous. He didn't want it to be ridiculous. He wanted it to be ridiculous and go like that extra little bit to, I guess, feel like a concrete vision. But it's, I don't know. I always think like it's admirable when somebody takes a risk like that. But I think she said the inspiration for that robe was like Ming Dynasty robes. So again, it's that meeting of the East and West, and it's just such an unusual image that again, like, goes totally against anything you might have associated with Dracula and the many, many films that
Yeah,
preceded it.
they wanted to bring in a lot of, I think, kind of Turkish imagery too, since this idea that like they wanted the idea that part of this story is from, a Byzantine era, and
Yeah.
that the beginning of Dracula's conflict is his fighting the Ottoman Empire, so they wanted that like even older, like ancient, more ancient moment to be like in your mind, even if the whole movie mostly takes place at the end of the 19th century.
I think, like, specifically, like the Byzantine mosaics, there's sort of a mosaic look to some of the costumes. And I think, like, a few other artists they mentioned that were more recent, like Gustav Klimt, I think was
Oh yeah.
obviously an influence. Like, that costume he's wearing at the end, looks just like a Klimt painting. I think they might have said Alphonse Mucha was another influence, that's sort of right around the period that the film's set in, that's maybe just like a general kind of aesthetic to draw on for a lot of those costumes that are more set in the period. But don't know, they're gorgeous.
There's a really interesting thing. Coppola kept, he's like, it came up in more than one interview with him that I read, and it was this idea that he wanted the costumes to be the sets, and that he was making a movie that could have been made in the early 20th century, where it would have been like, you know, basically almost no set on a stage, and so that the world that the actors are inhabiting is one that's made with the costumes.
Yeah, I think that really comes across in the film, because I don't know what kind of it was like a little bit of a tighter budget, I think.
Yeah,
considering how the film looks.
I couldn't help but think maybe Coppola was a little traumatized by how One with the Heart almost ruined him. Which I love that movie too.
I know, but that's the epitome of big sets, big fancy elaborate sets, and I think there's sort of an intimacy to his Dracula film that it does let the film kind of lean on the costumes a little bit more to give you a sense of that world without showing a kind of large scale grandeur that might be expensive.
But then it means that the costumes have to do actual world building. So all of these ideas that he had about bringing Byzantine and fin de siècle and symbolist painting and early cinema, mm-hmm. they all had to come together in the costumes.
Right.
And I think they do that. That's kind of
I think so. I mean, you do kind of take away a specific aesthetic from the film that most of it's from the costumes, you know, whether it's Dracula with the sunglasses when he's walking around during the day to meet Winona Ryder, or I think so much of the images you associate with that film are the costumes specifically. Like you said, they kind of steal the show.
Oh, man. One of the funny stories about in the book that they wrote is they wanted absinthe to be a big motif in the movie, and you only see them drinking absinthe once in the whole movie, but they wanted you to think the whole movie would feel like this sort of wormwood trip. And so Aker's original design for Dracula's wives was she just had them painted in green, and they ended up looking like zombies, and they showed up to set, and Coppola was like, oh my god, this looks horrible. No one would want to sleep with these women. They're supposed to be seducing him. So they had to take 2 weeks off, and she redesigned them in this sort of with a kind of more mummy, tattered idea, and it ended up working.
I think they have a little bit of those Turkish design motifs worked in the final version.
Yeah.
You don't get to see it as much. Or I know too, the mobility of the costumes was sort of an issue, especially with that suit of armor. I saw some of the behind the scenes footage where Gary Oldman was just kind of complaining about not being able to move, he's doing
that.
The scene and he's picks up a piece of the armor and he's and sighing. that looked a little bit tricky because it looks so. It doesn't look like it's made of metal. It has this sort of lacquered look to it. It could almost be ceramic it doesn't feel, it just looks really stiff and rigid, I guess.
Yeah.
It's, what I think is sort of funny, that same texture, that all red muscle looking texture, she reused that in the cell with the suits they use to go into people's minds. It has the exact same look to it.
Yeah,
so that
they got a different
carried over
material for that one.
Also, they didn't have to really move in that one. They just kind of lay in the air suspended.
Yeah, I guess they could have. they ended up getting, I think, a special effects sculpture to fabricate those, whereas it actually was plastic with leather joints and Dracula, and so he could barely move in them.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. They all they do is go up and down in those. Ones for the cell. They could have gone with plastic.
I think they're pretty cool. I like that. Most of that film, the costumes that are very elaborate that you associate with are in the sort of dreamscapes in the subliminal world of the film. But mm-hmm. that's one kind of tie in between the more elaborate stuff and the more mundane stuff. So I like that there's that one connection, you have to put on this sort of surreal looking suit to descend into somebody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, there's a lot of things I really like about The Cell, actually. It's a film I've watched, you know, maybe a dozen times over the last 15
really?
Years or however long
wow.
it's been out.
This was my first time watching it since I think when it came out, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, I have to say.
I find it like strangely rewatchable for a film that's you can kind of pick it apart. Like I find it's also kind of a film I have a hard time defending if somebody says that, oh, why do you like that? I'm like, I
Yeah.
don't know if I have a good answer. But you know, I think compared to sort of films that feel like they're in a similar kind of science fiction world, like Inception, I just find The Cell so much more visually appealing. You know, it's that like sort of fashion magazine spread version of surrealism that I'm kind of drawn to, I guess.
Yeah, I think my rewatching it might have been colored a little bit by I had just watched a press interview that Tarsem did for The Fall, and they asked him what his influences were, and he was like, "Well, I mean, aside from Tarkovsky, all I really watch is CSI and porn." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is like a perfect synthesis of those things." And like, I've just started watching those procedural drama, so I'm like, yeah, I have an appreciation for this now.
Always sort of suspected it's still kind of riding that wave of Silence of the Lambs inspired films, like the, you know, Jennifer 8 and 7. Like it feels a lot like 7, but it's like 7 meets the Matrix. And
Yeah.
I sort of wondered if that was part of the reason why it was greenlit. And I think in the audio commentary or one of the special features, Tarsem says like, yeah, I didn't even really care about the story. It just seemed like something people would like, and I just focused purely on the visual stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like a specific kind of schizophrenia that like only makes you unconscious and you're, I don't know, that whole thing was ridiculous. But who cares? Because Jennifer Lopez is like walking around. Well, first of all, in the real world, I know Eiko didn't do the costumes for the real world part, but there's a scene where she's sitting at her iMac and she's got these like square French tips on, and I was like living for that
I
look.
don't, like Jennifer Lopez has some really fantastic costumes when she goes inside the dreamscape. Like probably my favorite, my two favorite costumes in the film. It's after she kind of gets trapped in there, and Vince Vaughn has to come and rescue her, and she has this like very fancy metal piece on covering her face,
Oh
and
yeah, she
the
looks
way her
like
hair's
a
done up and.
evil bird.
Right, and there's like this weird seahorse motif all over the room, and Vincent D'Onofrio comes in, and he has this outfit which it has the same color palette as the Temple of the Golden Pavilion scenes in Mishima. Like it's that specific sort of green and gold, and he it's such a strange looking costume where he's clearly the king of his own world, but it's very striking, I find. And then he has like a little music box where he's pulling out Vince Vaughn's
Oh
intestines.
yeah, that costume I felt was like it was like a like gold is like a regal color, but it was like this kind of greenish gold. Like he's the king, but he's sort of this like corrupted, like tarnished version of it.
Exactly. And like his other costumes also have that sort of idea of the corrupted regal, like he's the king of his own domain, his own headspace, but it's a very dark and tortured place. Like when you first see him, I think it's in that room where the drapes end up being his cape.
Oh, I
And you know,
loved
it's
that
done
costume. It was
digitally, but
like,
it's such an interesting design.
yeah, it's giving you like this like fetish wear, but then it's like it's so big, it's like part of the whole room. And also, who knew like Vincent D'Onofrio could like model like these elaborate costumes so hard? That guy really is a chameleon,
That
right?
was Buff D'Onofrio.
Yeah.
That was Well, like there's a few other like fetish motif things like incorporated into the film, like you know when they're showing the different victims, each one's like its own little like art tableau sort of looking
Yeah.
space. And at the very end when like Vincent D'Onofrio goes into Jennifer Lopez's dreamscape, her headspace, and like he's the intruder, and all of a sudden like the tables are flipped, but he's this like intrusive viral kind of a force, and he comes out of the water, and he's got this reptilian looking cape, and he has this sort of twisted bar that seems to be clamped onto his nipples. Like, you know, it's such a again, like, outrageous but completely, I think, unforgettable image. And you know, Jennifer Lopez is dressed like a pink Virgin Mary. Like, it's just, you know, wild.
I got this impression of her character through the costumes that I don't think really shows through in like maybe the writing as much, that her character has this sort of savior complex. Like when at the beginning when she's trying to help the little boy, it's like she's in this like white, like feathery thing. It's like angelic almost. And when at the end, when we're inside her mind again, she's like the Virgin Mary. And yeah, I think that like the visual cues are important for letting us know that about her.
No, that's a good point. And like, a lot of the costumes do kind of realize that vision of somebody who's tortured that she's trying to save. Like, that you feel like some of the theme of the film is resting on the costumes specifically. Like, it's doing a part to tell the story in its own way. Like, I think because large sections of the film don't really have talking or exposition, and you know, it's purely just visual, you have to rely on things like that to help tell the story.
I think that helps it sort of transcend the, I mean, not that it helps it transcend. I think that's what separates this movie from like a straight to video psycho killer, you know, like gore fest kind of thing.
Exactly. Like, it's a similar thing in The Fall, where you have the real world and you have this sort of other more surreal landscape, which The Fall and The Cell are pretty similar in that way. But the other two she did with Tar Sim, like, they're all in that fantasy world. Like, there's no contrast with the real world, or they're sort of all rooted in fantasy. The last two, Immortals and Mirror Mirror. But I don't, did you get a chance to rewatch The Fall, or?
I do get to watch The Fall. I haven't seen Mirror Mirror like ever. Yeah, I should see it. It's been on like my list of like, you know, like a having a bad day, like watch kind of thing, but haven't gotten
That's
to
probably a
it.
good time to watch it. There's like a Bollywood dance sequence that ends the film that I really enjoy,
Oh,
actually.
hell yeah.
It just turns into a musical. And like, again, you see like a lot of recurring design motifs in the costumes. Like, I think the dwarves, one of them has an outfit where it's almost like Renfield's straitjacket. Like, it has that same kind of texture to it. And I don't, like, some costume designers, you almost get a sense of their work just based on the texture of the fabrics or other materials that they're using in the costumes, and certain kind of patterns that bring out textures. Like, that seems to be so much a part of how a costume designer might put their stamp on a particular costume. I don't know. It's again, like, sort of outside my realm of knowledge. But like, I think watching all these films together, you can definitely see, I guess, between the color choices and the textural choices, like, there's a commonality that you can say, you know, there's an individual artist behind a lot of these decisions.
Yeah, I think she was very collaborative the way she worked too. I don't think she liked to make a lot of designs in her office and then just sort of send them to the filmmaker and say this is how they are. I think, especially in the Tar Sim movies, like she did a lot of sort of sketching and ideas and going back and forth until they found something that worked exactly for the movie.
Like, she talks about, like, in The Immortals, how he wanted her to do some historical research, and how she wanted to blend historical with very far out ideas. And like, that comes across in that one. You know, if people have seen it, it's sort of, oh, that helmet looks familiar, or that armor chest piece looks familiar, but there's also something done to make it really stand out or make it really unique. So, yeah, no, I think you're right that she must have been very collaborative.
The
And
sort of making of The Fall is like a crazy story of collaboration altogether. Like they sort of like worked with the two main actors to do, they shot all the stuff that happens in Los Angeles first, and they altered ideas for the way the fantasy world would work based on the performances that they gave. And so they even had to, they were like, Iko was even doing costume designs after they shot the first part of the movie, like the X-ray technician turning into the henchman was
Oh.
a kind of on the fly thing.
I know it was like a really long production. That's one thing I always heard about it is all the locations they went to and just how long it took to film it all. But I kind of like when the group is all assembled and they look like a superhero team. It has that kind of a quality to the costumes, like and it almost made me think of that the Alan Moore League of Extraordinary Gentlemen or something like that. Like they look like comic book characters a little bit when you see them, or
Yeah, I mean, they're all
you know,
supposed
a
to.
kid's idea of heroes.
Yeah, they all exist in her mind, so of course they're all going to be like clear and distinct. Like, you have no doubt. Like, there's no point when you're watching The Fall where you're like, wait, who is that guy again?
Right.
Like.
One thing it seems like with Eiko Ishioka is her use of color. Like it tends to be very bold and makes things stand out. Like if, a lot of the costumes are very uniform, like all white, all red, and a lot of the times they seem to be chosen to be things that'll deliberately stand out. Like I think it's Lucy's costume at one point in Dracula. It's like bright orange when she's running through the shrubs
Yeah.
at night. And like that seems like such a unusual choice, having this like bright orange robe, but of course orange stands out from green. That's why the
Yeah.
people in the woods always have the orange hunting vests and things like that. And to have like such a strong contrast, I think it makes the costume immediately stand out. It makes them very easy to follow. That she doesn't just kind of blur into the
Yeah.
into the setting. So like a lot of the costumes, or even outside the costumes, like Mishima, I think of that bright pink food cart in one scene. Like you just can't miss it and can't not notice all the detail in it. And by having those kinds of bold color choices, it makes things stand out so much.
Yeah, that scene in particular, I remember it's they're actors walking in a circle and they're sort of like setting that it's like in the middle of the city, so there are like people who are supposed to be billboards, and I didn't catch that until I noticed that one guy had a traffic cone on his head, and I was like yes, that's what they're like.
Well, and then on top of that, there's that the sort of like surreal distortion by having them all walking one way while the centerpiece is rotated the opposite direction. So, like it just kind of creates this unusual sense of movement. Like you're on what are they called? The not a teeter-totter. What's the thing
A
in like kids? A
merry-go-round?
merry-go-round. Right, it's like a merry-go-round, but like the people are walking in the opposite direction that you're spinning, so it kind of doubles that momentum and creates again like sort of an unusual sense of motion.
Oh, speaking of which, and before we're too far away from the muscle costume idea, did you know she did the uniforms for the Canadian Olympic team in 2002?
I read that. I saw she did like some of the work for the Olympics. Did she do designs for the Beijing Olympics also?
Yeah, she did for the opening ceremony.
That's almost like a film production, just as big anyway.
Yeah.
Working with Zhang Yimou and like a lot of her work outside of film, it seemed like that was just one sort of small ass or one piece of what she did as an artist. The one that surprised me was her working on the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Oh yeah, I have to admit I'm not super familiar with Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, but I did read that she wanted to redesign his spider logo because as a graphic designer, like logos matter a lot to her. Like for Dracula, she came up with his family crest that you see in various parts of the film. So
The
yeah, she.
dragon and the phoenix, or
Yeah, I think it's like a mixture of animals that sort of become a dragon, but she felt the current Spider-Man logo was too reminiscent of the 60s of the
Right,
original
it was like
Spider-Man comics, so
very sort of simple, basic, the original, and she made sort of a more elaborate, like the there's little blue inlays in between it and stuff like that I noticed. And I was looking at some of the pictures. They're really out there. And I don't, I've never seen it, but that's one thing I was always curious about. Julie Taymor, and it just like it seems like such an unusual combination of talents. And I was always kind of curious what the end product was like. I don't, like, sometimes it seems
Ooh, I'm
like
looking at them now. They're nuts.
I know, right? There's like characters where I don't even know if they're a Spider-Man character or if they were just created for the musical, but they look so out there.
This one guy has like cheetah pants, and then there's like a whole like constructed lion head on like that's his torso. And then this other bad guy is like a bunch of ice. This seems cool. I would watch this just to not see somebody fall on accident.
That was like the primary reason why so many people were going to see it during the previews, was just hoping somebody would get stuck for half an hour in the air. Or that seemed like the big
Mean,
draw, was just to watch it go awry. I was thinking how some productions it's like, oh, just throw money at it till you solve the problem. Other productions, it's like, just throw talent at it, like Julie Taymor, great costume designers, and make it great, make it art.
yeah.
It almost seemed like one of those where, like, it doesn't matter how many people were thrown at that project, it just wasn't going to
Right.
be a success.
And The Edge.
But I
Who
don't
doesn't
know.
love U2's The Edge?
I'm sure they're well liked.
The Applebee's of pop music. All right.
Oh, I saw also, before she worked with Coppola on the Dracula, she also did designs for the episode of Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater that he directed, where Harry Dean Stanton plays Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah.
And I think I've seen it like maybe 20 years ago, but I was kind of
Oh, I
curious
watched
if
it. It's on YouTube.
it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I've seen that one because I remember the library that we had close by when I was a kid. I used to rent those, and that's where I saw like Aladdin, which, oh, that's the first thing Tim Burton directed. And like so many people worked on that who were talented that later
Oh,
on you realize,
yeah.
like, oh, it's and all these famous actors and famous talented people behind the camera. But I know, so like it's kind of interesting that she did have that longer working relationship with Coppola. I know it's there were like a few other credits I noticed that she had that I didn't have a chance to see. Like there was a film she worked on called Closet Land, which I just saw the pictures of it. It had Alan Rickman, and I think it was probably as a production designer, because there's like these interesting columns and like checkered floors, and it looks sort of like this interesting abstract space. But I have no idea what the film was about.
Huh.
And there were a couple others. I think she did music videos with Bjork. A
Yeah.
couple of them, yeah.
I know of at least one, and it's like if you look at these movies we're talking about and then look at this music video, you'll be like, oh yeah, of course she did that. It's like Bjork is like all white and nude, and then she has these like red strings coming out of her breast, like her nipples are making like silk, and she becomes like cocooned in it, and like she's gonna become a butterfly. And yeah, it's all in like one straight single shot. It's pretty cool.
I'm trying to think. I've probably
What is
seen
it
it at
called?
some point, but
Yeah.
the nipples are a thing I always noticed in like partly in her costumes, like the Vincent D'Onofrio one, but like just looking at some of her design work for magazines and advertising, like she'll do these outfits where the like I don't know, the top of the shirt or dress, it's like right below the nipples. I saw that was like in a few of her designs, so I don't know,
Yeah, I
that's
think
one
that
thing
was
that
like
shows up in the
a
cell.
lot. I think it that was like really unusual in fashion ads, especially in Japan at the time, and like that was really like part of her borrowing from like maybe more Italian fashion design ideas and making that like international style, and like the human body is an international visual motif, like everyone knows the human body.
Right. Well, and like a lot of the models she worked with too, like I noticed they're not necessarily Japanese. From that period of her career, it seemed like she worked with models from other countries, like you said. And I don't, she talked a little bit about like going on to the Mishima project. She sort of said she felt like she didn't fit in that much with the hardened Toho crew working on it. And she said, like, when she first showed up, like, she was wearing, you know, something very fashionable. And she said, just, like, getting these stares from people who were very, I guess, blue collar. And then gradually as she went on, she said, like, simplified her outfit and wouldn't put on makeup. And, just trying to fit in with the group of people she had to work with. But I don't know, like, from what they said on the audio commentary, it seemed like the Mishima film was, like, a lot of people didn't necessarily want to work on it, either because it was, like, a Western-helmed production, or because Mishima himself was sort of a figure they might not necessarily want to be associated with, or,
right.
You know, they weren't sure how the film would turn out. So I don't know if they needed a more unusual group of people working on the production to realize that.
Yeah, like sort of bringing an outsider perspective kind of
thing. I think so, like, which again makes sense because Mishima is sort of a, you know, one of those ultimate outsider figures. I mean, are there any favorite costumes that you have, or are there any that we didn't bring up that you wanted to mention or highlight?
I feel like we barely talked about the fall at all.
Well, we can talk more about the fall. Like,
let me see. Oh man, favorite costumes from the fall. They all look so good.
I know they're all. I love how the there's like that fan mask piece. Like it sort of looks like a flower headdress, and the petals are almost like a fan coming down, covering the face.
I love that.
And it splits down the middle. Like that's such a great mask design. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of fantastic masks in the fall. Like.
Oh, the one character who has, like, the horn headpiece, like,
oh, yeah.
Is so beautiful. Because that character, it's, like, his costume is mostly his body, and, like, but
right,
the headpiece
he's pretty close to being naked.
Him, yeah, but the headpiece sets him in, like, the fantasy world.
Those horns, and like, I think it's, like, beads kind of coming down from the helmet. Like, I think, like you said, because the character's wearing so little, like, it makes sense that the one thing he's wearing should be very distinct and very maybe ornate. But yeah, like it's sort of interesting, like when you look at them all side by side, like it's the color palettes are very simple, and it's like green and gold, white and red, black and gold, red and gold, like they all have kind of two-tone, one-tone looking costumes, you know, they really grab your attention, you know. And there's sort of I mean, like in a lot of the locations that they choose and a lot of the visuals created for that film, it seems to be based on just what'll stand out the most. You know, you'll have like the bright blue sky and the yellow desert and then like a splash of red. Like it's designed to be very eye-catching and dynamic, I think.
Although, you know, the bandit's costume, he's just basically in black. And part of the film, he's wearing a blue cape, but other times he's not. I think he has to kind of be able to change because our perception of him changes through the movie, because at the beginning we trust him, and then by the middle of the movie we don't trust him anymore, and then we have to root for him at the end.
Well, and then you need a little version of the bandit costume, because at one point she's the bandit, the little girl. And Tarsem, he's an interesting guy. Like, I think some people sort of object to the how much of his designs and inspiration comes from other artists.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's unintentional, though. I don't know. I kind of like that he doesn't seem to have an anxiety of influence, because there is, like, sort of no visual culture that exists in a void. I think, like, part of what I like about the fall is it's about how we sort of synthesize things from outside of our lives to tell stories, and sort of, you know, the world gets filtered by you and you filter it back out into another story, and it's like this cycle, and that sort of like becomes the magic of narrative art.
There's a certain sense to going inside this person's mind, and there's like a recreation of a Damien Hirst piece in there with the horse, or, you know, like it's
oh, you mean in the cell?
Yeah, in the cell, I mean.
And then there's the whole like illuminated manuscript thing when we go into J-Lo's brain.
Right. Oh my, that sort of there's like the digital mandala, or I'm not sure what you'd call it, but like it's with CGI and it just kind of fills up the frame of the image. I don't know, I like that so much. I mean, that's not the costumes, but like it just, seems to take its cues from that and feels like it's part of the world. And how the designs that are meant to be of a piece and give you a sense of this person's headspace. I like that.
Oh, speaking of paintings in these movies, did you notice in Mishima when inside the wild horses part, when he comes to assassinate the politician, he has the big painting on his wall. It's a Delacroix painting, and it's based on a Lord Byron play.
Okay.
And I love that because they're like, aren't there parts where Mishima compares himself to Lord Byron in the rest of the film? Because he, was a writer and he actually like volunteered to go to war in Greece in their fight of independence against the Ottoman Empire. And so I thought that was a good art historical cue.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the getting a bit off topic, but like one of the most striking images in the film is Mishima recreating the Saint Sebastian piece, like how it's that sort of violent image that he kind of associates with his sexual awakening, and then he recreates it. It sort of feels like he has that, I don't know, like crossed wires where it's this like impulse to pursue his own kind of violent death fantasy, like it's I'm not sure what it is, but like it's just such a startling image.
Yeah, he really did that. Like, you can see that
I know, I
photo.
know, it's I mean, a lot of his work, like it's very like I sort of found out about him through the film and then went and read some of his stories and found out about who he was more after seeing it. But like it's startling when you watch his the short film he did, Patriotism, where it's him basically recreating what he would really do ahead of time. Like it just seemed like this very specific fantasy or art piece that he just was working towards for such a long time. It's strange. I like that in the behind the scenes, the making of Eiko Ishioka said she thought Mishima had bad taste. Which might be true. Like you see his uniforms. Like he designed his own uniform. What you watch in the film, that's actually his real outfit, his costume. And like it looks militaristic, but it's almost like the way like a Tom of Finland drawing of a soldier would look,
Oh, yeah,
Like there's
totally.
something again, like a little bit like fetishistic about it. It's difficult to say why, but it looks like, as much as it resembles sort of an officer's uniform, there's also something that I don't know, like there's something sexual about it at the same time. But
There's like a decadence in all of these movies,
decadence, yeah,
but they all make sense in their own
right.
context. Like they're all decadent in very different ways for different reasons.
Right, like I think a lot of these costumes, they sort of work specifically because they're in these fantastical states, like specifically the fantasies of characters, of their internal lives. It's what we fantasize maybe we could wear, even if it's not practical. And the Dracula, it seems so hypnotic and dreamlike, or maybe even absinthe-like. And I kind of wondered if these costumes might not necessarily work if you try to present them in a more realistic setting, because nobody dresses like this, or like that's sort of the fun of it
I think
is
she figured out how to play to a camera really well as
right
she worked
right
more and more in film. Like, I don't think she would have ended up doing the Olympics if she hadn't been able to sort of figure out how things read. Because the whole purpose of that production was so the whole world would see on TV, like the Beijing
Right.
opening ceremonies, and go, wow, China's great.
It was definitely a wow factor. I know it's interesting artist, interesting body of work. She could work with somebody like Tarsem, and it seems like she might have had, even if it was like a more creative, a collaborative process, it's more or less a free rein to create and explore her designs without really worrying about certain limitations,
Yeah,
I think.
she doesn't strike me as someone who would compromise a lot on her
No,
visions.
and like I kind of wonder too, like the film Tarsem did after she passed away, the one with Ben Kingsley and Ryan Reynolds where they switch bodies.
Oh, you know what's funny about that movie? I've totally seen it, and I don't remember anything about it. I mean,
Well, I was
I
just
was
thinking,
like,
like,
watching it in the background or
oh,
whatever,
what was
but
that called?
yeah.
Selfless. I think it was called Selfless, right? But that film, you sort of feel like that's one thing that it's kind of lacking is that kind of boldness of design. And I don't know, like it seemed almost like you can feel her absence in his films when he, or the film he made since. And like now he's doing that TV show, The Emerald City.
Yeah. Oh, you know who's doing the costumes on it though? Or I guess did, because I don't think it's on anymore. But they got the costume designer from the Star Wars prequels. I
Oh,
love
it
her
looks.
work too.
I think I made like a mental note that they looked a little bit Star Wars prequel-y when I saw
Yeah. I think her approach is
it.
similar, like, because I know in Star Wars, like, especially with Amidala, she wa like this idea
Yeah.
of taking like historic resource like sources and then like redoing them in a fantastic way. Like, if nothing else
Right.
about the Star Wars sequels, like you remember what Princess Amidala looked like.
There's some good costumes in the prequels. It's not all brown robes.
Yeah.
It's true. I don't know. So it's too bad she's passed away. Like it's, we basically talked about just six films. That's not that many, but each one sort of is full of interesting things, memorable things. So, yeah.
Her body of work is still huge, like
No,
outside of
that's true. Yeah.
film. Yeah, like I don't even know how many stage productions she did, how many album covers she designed. Yeah.
No, that's true too. That's a good point. It's a big body of work out there, but I'm a film person. I'm a simple person, Emma. I was
I'm
just thinking,
just a
like, again.
simple film watcher.
I've just got a Blu-ray in my player and a song in my heart. Is there anything we didn't mention that you want to say or? Okay. Should I ask where people can find you on the internet? Or are you good?
I mean, you can use your usual internet stalking techniques. I'm not, invisible.
Okay.
But I'm not
I
on Twitter.
All right. Yeah, well, thank you for coming on and pitching such an interesting topic. It was fun to dive into and look at all these lovely costumes and appreciate the swan hat and mirror and all that. So thank
Man,
you.
I gotta watch Mirror Mirror now. Well, thank you for indulging me.
Well, I guess yeah, and until next time, folks. Take care and take care.